Hello, I'm the Duchess of Rutland. I'm so excited to be back with you for another season of Duchess, and this one will be extra special. I'm so grateful I've been able to travel around the country, see beautiful houses, and meet extraordinary people. But I've wanted to finally bring you inside and share all the magic we have here at our very own home, Beaver Castle. So in this six-part limited season, we are exploring my home, Grantham's Great Jewel. Bringing you every piece of its history, art, and culture, all of its past, its present, and the future. So I hope you enjoy this very special season. This is Duchess. Last week on the podcast, I met with Orlando Rock, chairman of Christie's UK, to discuss the art and heirlooms at Beaver. I also shared a conversation with Philip and Emma, joint managing directors of Civil Colfax, to discuss the interiors and design of Beaver Castle. It was a fascinating episode, so please make sure you listen to it if you haven't already. For our final episode in this very special season, I think it's important we turn our minds not only to the past, but also towards the future. These privately owned grand homes have always been a centre of both culture and commerce. Today, I'll be speaking about the business, historically, what it is now in the present, and indeed what it's going to be in the future. And today, I'm speaking to the person who has been on a journey with me for the last year, helping me as CEO. Let's start today's episode, which will be the final episode of the season, by learning a little bit more about you. Could you tell us what your role is here at Beaver and how you started working here?
So I'm here at Beaver Castle as your chief executive and someone that tries each day to work alongside you and bring to life, I think, the extraordinary projects here at Beaver Castle and to help you make your vision a reality.
And tell me, what were you doing before, Emma?
I was running a wonderful theatre in Toronto called Soul Pepper. And my background is entirely as a theatre producer and a manager of arts and cultural organisations.
And before Canada?
Before Canada, I ran the wonderful Bristol Old Vic down in the southwest, which is England's oldest working theatre. So built in 1766, it has an extraordinary heritage of its own. And I spent a long time there working with a fabulous team, raising money and renovating the theatre and bringing its heritage to life. So I guess that gave me a bit of a background in heritage and an inkling that I might really enjoy working in a space like this.
So Emma, just out of interest, what is the link between working in a theatre and working in a stately home, although many days I do think I live on a theatre stage?
For me, actually, it all comes down to storytelling. Telling and sharing stories is a wonderful way to build community and for us to remember our commonality, actually, and our common links. And I think speaking to you and meeting you for the first time, I think you too are really passionate about storytelling at Beaver. And actually, we only have to hear you talking about the fifth Duchess and your connections to the past and your passion for bringing alive the stories of the estate and the castle to know that actually that is theatrical. I think of it as a stage set. Others might think of it as a film set. And for you, of course, it's a home, which is rather extraordinary. But for me, it's storytelling is at the heart of it.
What made you actually come and spend your time here?
I mean, it's not every day that a duchess offers you a job in a castle. So there's a certain kind of intrigue that comes in that moment, I think. And I've always loved visiting places like this. And I was a lucky kid whose parents would take me to historic houses and parklands most weekends when I was a kid. And so I've got a real sort of sense of the magic and a sort of nostalgic memory for what it is to engage with stately homes. I still love it with my parents, actually. I mean, they adored visiting Beaver and I was able to show them around. It was a real treat of a day, you know, for a city girl to come to the countryside. That's been an adventure, and to step into a business where enormous parts of it were completely new to me. And at this point in my career, that's been a really exciting challenge, actually.
And so, Emma, and trust me, I'm fully aware that I'm not easy. So you can be honest with your reply. How have you found working with me?
I suppose in my experience, I sort of think of you as the artistic director of Beaver Castle. That then is a very familiar dynamic for me because I've worked with extraordinary artists throughout my career. And I think of you as another one of them. So I love the fact that every day you're full of ideas and a real clarity of vision for the future of Beaver. And my job then is to work with you and try to make that possible and try to support the staff team and make sure we have the systems, the structures, the personnel, the plans in place so that those visions become a reality.
I would say that most probably you have in every possible way fulfilled all those expectations as far as I'm concerned. Because of course it is an enormous transition for me as you take someone on to help you hand over the running of, I always say this is like my sixth child. So I would imagine I'm not the easiest to work with because I'm very hands-on. And I know what's happening everywhere. Mm. So there's nothing that doesn't get back to me somehow.
No.
And that must be very frustrating.
What I've tried to do anyway is respect the fact that you've built this business over a number of years. From that moment you first stepped in, Beaver has been utterly transformed under your leadership. And I suppose I'm always, sometimes in the morning, I'm like, oh, how has she got to that before me? Or how does she know that before I do? And actually the truth is that you were probably up at 6 o'clock walking around the roof and seeing what was going on and out with the farmers and walking around the castle. And I have enormous admiration for your capacity to be everywhere and know everything and be across everything. And so I'm trying to sort of catch up sometimes. And I suppose try to help you prioritize. Like, what is the thing we have to achieve today when there is so much that is swirling around? And I think I often say, I always think of myself as almost the sort of metronome. Right, here's where we are. Let's try and stay steady. Here's what we're trying to achieve today. And there'll be another 15 ideas, I'm sure, by lunchtime. But let's try and keep going and stay steady and get the job done that needs doing today.
Well, I'm very sad you never met my father, but he would always say, I think she'll have 100 ideas by lunchtime and one might be half a good one. So he would definitely be looking down and saying, Emma, it's not an easy job working with my Em. I'm sure you've got loads of questions you want to ask me, so fire ahead.
Well, since we're on the topic of business, it would be really interesting to start off by understanding a bit more of the history here at Beaver. How did the estate make its money originally? I mean, we weren't open to the public 150 years ago. What was it like back then?
At that time, we had a lot of coal mines in Derbyshire. And I think they were paying off the building of this building.
The estate was much bigger then.
Yes, of course. Yes, and we hadn't had the influence of inheritance tax and capital gains and so forth. So I think David would agree, there was much planning that went in. They didn't actually have death duties then, did they? So there was a succession of not great planning and living off the fat of the land and the assets. And then it wasn't until when we looked in the archives, Duchess Violet's time, that I found her diary once, and I was fascinated to read about her ideas about the tapestries in the Regent's Gallery. And she wrote in her own handwriting, "If we were rich, I would surround these tapestries with a marble border, but I suppose they could always be sold for death duties." So that was in Duchess Violet's time, which was Victorian times. And then, of course, the ninth Duke, who was very much an archivist, and he died very suddenly without any planning for death. And so that's when a huge amount of the lands were sold. And even the mineral rights were sold. And it was reduced right down to pretty much the land mass that we have today. So since that time, I think the family really seriously woke up and thought, we have to really get our act together with planning for death. My understanding of heritage is a bit like a hot potato. The moment you've got it, you want to throw it on because there's no point in living and really owning too much of it because the likelihood, well, if something tragic happened, you've lost the lot. So our entirety of living here, Emma, has been planning for that time, which is very difficult for a Duke to talk about, really, because I always feel one's always talking about his death because that's what you're planning. It's rather depressing, isn't it?
Yes.
but that's how it is.
Yes.
And they're very pragmatic. And I think Dave is incredibly practical and pragmatic about it. And we've had one meeting after another with lawyers and guiders. But I think your question was, how did they make their money? I think they made their money from rents, from farms, from the coal. They had mineral rights all over the country. They still had some land up in Yorkshire. They owned Helmsley at one time. So it's been just a contraction over time. And the big time that changed these houses forever was, of course, the First and Second World War. And when they went off to war in the Second World War, nothing was ever really to be the same. And it was my father-in-law, I remember, who my mother-in-law told me this story. You know, when he came back from the Second World War, bearing in mind the three boys went together, and poor dear Kaku, my husband's granny, Kaku, she was a tenant who married the ninth Duke. Her husband had died and her three sons were on the front line, and she had no idea whether or not she was going to lose them, but they all came home. And so Charles, when he came back into this house after those years, and everything had been stored and put in a few rooms with all these government documents, his whole world has condensed in his thinking of how to live in them. So that's one of the things I always felt. I was going to take away the ropes, open up the building, and make it all come back to life. Because he was just so surprised he was here at all.
So you mentioned that it was really the two world wars that changed life here on the estate. Could you just talk about that a bit more? What was it that made a real difference?
Well, of course, the staff all went off and found careers following the war. And education became a huge thing that changed that whole thing of working in service. And so you didn't have the volume of people and to work here. So that changed the dynamics enormously. And also, I think it was a very tough financial time, because coming out of the Second World War, there was really no money. And also there was a big depression going on with the country in the 50s. It was really tough. And we were actually one of the first ever houses to open to the public because of the need for money to help support the running of it. So that was key.
I mean, we have a brilliant but small household team here at the moment. And presumably in days gone by, there were housekeepers and chefs. And I mean, this would have been full of people, right? Looking after the family.
Yes, and looking after the family and looking after the guests that came to stay, plus all the butlers that came to stay and all the ladies' maids that came to stay. And, you know, I think we had about 40 members of staff, and hence the old servants' hall where they all ate. And downstairs, we've got all the records in the archives of what they would eat in a year, plus all the beer that was consumed by the staff, because lunchtime would be a time of gathering on long tables in the old servants' hall, and they put jugs of beer in the middle. They most probably were slightly tipsy when they went back to work. But anyway, but you would imagine every tower had one of those lead baths. We've got stacks of those up in the towers now. And those lead baths, you know, and they're carrying all the water right up the tower. My father-in-law's bedroom was right at the top of the flag tower. The three boys had their rooms in a line.
It was a hard day's work, isn't it?
It was very tough. But there was a real community here. And we're never on our own now, are we?
So what was the sort of change in headcount then, if we had a staff pre-war, post-war?
Well, that would be really interesting, because I remember when actually the Beckhams were staying here some years ago, and Victoria turned to me and asked me how many cleaners we had here. And I remember thinking at the time, well, goodness, I think we've got about 1.5 full-time cleaners for the whole castle, maybe 2 at a stretch. And she'd got a few more than we had. So that was fascinating. However, then my mother-in-law even remembers teams of cleaners going across the floors on their hands and knees, scrubbing floors and polishing them. And in Violet's day, and that was before the wars, there was about 40 to 50 living in the castle, and then about 25 in the kitchen gardens, and about the same on the farm. So it was hundreds of people, and all the local villages, particularly Woolsthorpe, were really devoted to people who were working on the estate.
Your carriage awaits. The countdown to Christmas is on as the clock strikes 12 on the 18th of November 2022. Beaver Castle will be transformed into a breathtaking Cinderella-themed scene. Wander through the lavishly decorated spaces for an unforgettable family Christmas experience. For tickets, visit beavercastle.com.
I hope you enjoyed the first half of the conversation. Coming up, Emma and I talk about our vision for how we see the estate evolving in the future. Let's get back to the show. And coming back to now, Emma, what would you say is the commercial structure of Beaver today?
Beaver is, I think, at today's count, about 20 different businesses. And that changes all the time, actually, because new initiatives crop up and we start new businesses to support that. It's a multi-layered piece, actually, here. But we have television projects, we have audio projects like this one. We have so much going on. It feels like there's 101 startups. You know, there's a lot of new ideas. And what we're trying to do is constantly find the commonality, find the brand that sits across all of that. And I think it's a place of enormous opportunity, actually. I mean, there's so much that we can do, and we know, and I think post-COVID, it's become very clear that people are interested in the staycation, in the leisure experience they have at home, in a day out rather than a holiday away. And going into the period that we're facing now, I think our challenge is to stay affordable, stay relevant, and keep a price point on what we do that does deliver for the business, but means it's something that people can afford. It's got to be the little treat as well as the immense luxury. You know, it's got to be something that people can come and enjoy their day out here and not break the bank. From your perspective, what are the current challenges here at Beaver?
Well, we're going, as you say, into a very difficult time. And I think you're absolutely right. We've got to be that place that people can go to and think, I'm not going to get on a plane, but we're going to have an affordable day out where we can go and touch base with the countryside and with some fun and some history. And so one of the challenges for me is how to make that visitor attraction more interesting. Because I think when we first arrived, we closed the castle to the public. We're only actually open for 30 days a year. And so now, since COVID, we've changed that overnight, in a sense. We're developing the engine yard, this little retail village. And so we've really got to get in gear with that visitor attraction. That's where I really see the growth. One of my ongoing challenges is the roof. And only a few years ago in this room, we found dry rot. So doing inspections, checking up how it is, ongoing program of restoring all these windows in the castle. Bearing in mind, I'm nearly 60 now. And I guess, I don't know what time I'll retire, when Charles is ready, most probably, to take over. I suppose I really want to get everything in line and ready for one day him coming in and saying, right, Mama, off you go. I'm ready now. That'll come and that'll happen. And then I really hope personally that another door opens for me and I have something to do where I can use all the experience that I've gathered here and give something back again, because my journey here has been very much about devoting my every living moment to either my family or this estate. And that can be incredibly wearing. And so I'd really like to be able to find the space and time to open another door on my life over the next 7 years, I guess.
So I know from listening to other podcast episodes that you typically ask your peer group, what does it cost to keep the lights on? So can I throw that back to you then?
That's a cheeky one, Emma, because you actually do know that one. Well, COVID was such a shock. You did feel running these houses as if you were going a bit into a war zone. Somehow, we just scraped our way through. But you've got to remember, standing still, this building costs over $500,000 a year. So there was no revenue coming in, plus the ongoing costs. Looking back at history, when you look back at the three Manners girls growing up here during war years, so that would be Marjorie, Diana and Letty. You know, Diana became a nurse in London. Marjorie was helped run a hospital here. So, it's adapting. And that's the really interesting thing I find about the aristocracy, is how adaptable they are. Mm. It is that adaptability of these families that I find fascinating. And also, and I have to give this to the guys who inherit the line, they are incredibly practical at marrying the right people at the right time. Because every one of the girls that I've met is hands-on, they roll up their sleeves, really? And they get on with the day job.
Yeah, pressure's on Charles then.
He'll most probably go for the absolute opposite to me. I hope he does anyway. As we well know, these homes, they really do need to evolve and adapt to survive. Can you just share with me, how do you think we should be evolving moving forward?
I mean, I think we're on the right track. I don't think there's a big sort of U-turn needed or a big corner to turn. I think it is about finding the ways of welcoming that more and more of the public want to come here and explore the landscape, the heritage, the community here at Beaver. Of course, we have to respect the fact that it's a private home and find a way that the family are happy and have the space and the time that they need to be in their home. But I think the business at Beaver is about appealing to the public. And I think it's partly an offer of heritage education, partly an offer of leisure and hospitality. And on from there, I think ultimately, hopefully, a place of art and culture. And I think we're already teasing at that in so many different ways. We've just had our first music festival here this summer, which was a huge hit. We had our first evening of opera in the ballroom, which was boutique, but I think promised a lot for the future. And so I don't think that's an evolution, but I think it is just continuing to push in the direction we're going.
Because obviously it's been a transitional time for you because you're about to fly the nest to another role back in the theatre world. Mm. But for me, this time I've had with you has been magical, really.
Oh, thank you.
And tell me, what do you feel, Emma, you have learned from this experience that you're going to take with you back into the theatre world?
I think I've learned a lot more about running a sort of multifaceted, multi-layered set of businesses. And actually, theatres are multiple businesses as well, not quite to this extreme. But theatres are often performing arts companies, heritage buildings, restaurants, bars. And I've spent a year really in the depths of those sorts of challenges, you know. And so I think it's enlivened a sort of commercial side to my brain that I have to be practicing. You know, it's not in my immediate nature to prioritise the commercial, because I've been incredibly lucky to work in subsidised theatre, so therefore running a charity up until now. So to be in a place that has to be commercially minded, that's been incredibly helpful to me, actually, because we are, as we've been saying, balancing a commercial imperative but with a public offering. I can really take that into theatre, actually, and go, okay, we are using subsidy and grants and donations, we are making a piece of art, but we've got to make some money to keep the lights on, to keep the ship rolling, you know, to keep going. I've seen that very closely here, and that, I think, will make me a much better theatre executive in the future.
Oh, that's great.
How do you think we make a case for the future of private heritage?
Well, perhaps I should ask you, having been here. What do you feel?
There is a very, very particular level of care and investment and work that you get from a family, because you're the kind of ultimate staff members in a way, because you partly got no choice. You've got to make it work. And I think it has to be about creating spaces for people, you know, places of respite, places of solace, places to uplift. I mean, it's got to be about creating this as a place for community.
You're absolutely right, Emma, and I totally embrace those comments. And if we can keep this together and we can share it with people, because it is a partnership with people, if we can do that, there is so much for the future and children to learn from the past. And the past writes the history for the future. And if we can keep telling the stories with magic and passion and relative to whatever's happening in the world at that time, these places will survive for another 1,000 years. And I'm certainly not going to build another castle. This is the fourth and final castle.
And the last thing I wanted to ask you, Grace, was thinking back 20-odd years ago when you first walked in here as the Duchess. I can't possibly imagine what that day must have been like. I mean, so much emotion. I imagine it was quite scary. I imagine it was a time of opportunity. But can you see yourself then and see how you've changed? Give us a snapshot of the Duchess on day one and who
you
are.
Well, maybe
as a
I should
today.
Take you back to Miss Emma Watkins on Betty on the farm on the Welsh borders. Mm. And that's my go-to memory. Mm. And I suppose, what did I have in that little girl that I've taken with me to this moment? And the big thing is innate rule breaker, incredibly focused on where I'm going. Don't take too much notice. This is a fault of what other people say. And I have a very tunnel vision about where I'm going. And hopefully still can have some fun with life and remain absolutely that Welsh farmer's daughter. Mm. In a role I'm playing. It's a theatre. Life's a stage. And I'm just playing the game of doing what in many ways is expected of me as a Duchess in the 21st century. But the reality is, as you know, behind closed doors, we're all on the same level. This is a very flat structure. And every one of my team know they can come to my office at any time and talk. I've got a big family. And my bigger family is my team around me. And I've nurtured everyone that's here who stay with me for my journey. I'm as loyal to them as they are to me. But loyalty comes with time. Well, Emma, can I just wish you all the very best for your future? I hope the doors of the theatres reopen to you and Theatreland will be very happy to have you back with them. It's been a delight working with you and I've really enjoyed your passion and vision for heritage. Thank you, Emma.
Well, thank you, Your Grace. It's been an incredible adventure to spend a year here and I shall treasure it a great deal.
That's all we have for you in this season on the show. I think it's poignant we finish with our eyes fixed to the horizon, looking to the future. These houses, as much as they glimpse into the past, must adapt and evolve with the times. As the old phrase goes, for everything to remain the same, everything must change. I just have a few final things to share with you. Please follow the podcast where you listen to them. So to keep up with the times, we've just started a TikTok account. And if you're interested in additional behind-the-scenes content, please follow at Duchess the Podcast. Also, I love to learn more about you and your story. Please write to me at our listener inbox. The email address you need is duchess@duchessthepodcast.com or visit our website. This show was produced by One Fine Play in collaboration with Beaver Castle. From Beaver Castle, Violet Manners is the executive producer. From One Fine Play, James Bishop is the executive producer. Kasra Ferruzia is the editor and producer. Connor Foley is the editorial producer and researcher. Selena Christofidis is the graphic designer. I've been your host, the Duchess of Rutland. And this has been Duchess.